I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Joe Illick. He is the artistic director of the Santa Fe Concert Association and Jean-Michel Charbonnet, who is a world-renowned soprano. This Saturday at 4 o'clock at the United Church of Santa Fe, the two of them will be doing a program. Joe will be talking about Richard Wagner's life. They'll be doing selections from Tristan and Isolde, including the Liebestod. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you both on the show. Now let's talk about Tristan and Isolde. This is a revolutionary opera. It's a very important opera in the history of opera. Why is that?
It tells a story in a way that suspends time. Wagner was quite a lover. He had a lot of women in his life. He never hesitated to have children with other people's wives. But he nevertheless wrote to a friend that he was unhappy and had never found true love. So to really create true love, he had to write an opera.
I was reading somewhere that he was writing Tristan and Isolde, and he showed part of it to three women. His wife, his lover, and his future lover were all in the audience. What a guy.
Yeah. What a guy, yeah. So we might as well say right up front, Wagner was kind of a monster. However, he was one of the greatest geniuses that has ever lived. And although his personal behavior went beyond having affairs to actually being in such debt that he was considered a criminal and was chased from several countries, he created a dozen operas that are still regarded as great masterpieces.
Now, Tristan and Isolde, do you want to tell us? I mean, he wrote both the libretto and the music?
He did. He did that every time.
And tell us the origins of this story. He got it out of the history of German literature?
Well, Tristan and Isolde actually comes before Germany, but the original story, which was 12th century, made its way to Germany, and there are lots of different versions of the legend, but Wagner tailored it to his own needs. Basically, there is a king of Cornwall, who has a nephew, and the nephew's name is Tristan. Tristan has a battle with an enemy of his uncle, and that enemy is named Morolt. Morolt, just bear with me, right? Morolt is engaged to an Irish princess named Isolde. Tristan kills Morolt, and Isolde, for some reason, when she has the opportunity to kill Tristan, instead heals him.
Well, even to add to that, Tristan not only knows of Isolde, he gets in a boat, injured, and ends up at Isolde to be healed, knowing that she is a great healer.
Knowing so also that he her killed her fiancé.
He killed her fiancé, yes. Now you play the role of Isolde all over the world. Why do you think Isolde forgives Tristan instead of just killing him when she has the chance?
Right away. Well, remember, he presents himself as Tantris.
So but she figures it out.
She figures it out when she takes, as she says, she has the sword of her dead, or
fiance.
He has Tristan's sword of her dead fiancé, which killed her dead fiancé, and she takes from his head a splinter, and it's a splinter that matches the sword that the man who's come to her to be healed, Tantris, has missing from his sword.
Right.
So she therefore knows that it's
Tristan.
She
knows he's the one that killed her beloved.
There are lots of arguments about whether Tristan and Isolde are in love with each other. Is it the potion that causes the love? I have to believe, generally, when I'm playing the character, although I have directors that have convinced me to try different ways, that Isolde falls in love with Tristan right away, with Tantris.
And this is, by the way, before the opera even starts.
Yeah, this is all before we even begin the opera.
Ah, so we don't see any of this.
We're just giving you some backstory here.
No, this backstory is Isolde shares with you during her narrative in the first act.
Ah, so you sing this story.
Yeah, I sing this story.
So where does it actually start?
Well.
Yes, go ahead, Joe.
Okay. King Mark needs a wife. Like many dynasties, you need to marry somebody from the enemy side in order to guarantee political safety. So he has chosen his Irish bride, and he has chosen his nephew Tristan to bring his Irish bride to him on a ship. So the opera opens on the ship
from Ireland to Cornwall. And I actually think Tristan goes back after he's healed and says to King Mark, "I found the bride for you, Isolde, the Irish princess."
So he fixes her up with
his
uncle.
He's a tenor. He's kind of
and
dumb.
And then steals her away from
basically
the same guy he fixed
well,
her up
with.
Well,
now he doesn't steal her away.
Yes. It's not quite that simple. That would be too easy.
I haven't seen it, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
So
Isolde is very versed in the magical arts, as is her mother. Isolde does not want to marry King Mark. She doesn't want to be on the ship. She doesn't want to be leaving Ireland. She doesn't want any part of any of this. So her mother has packed up in her suitcase a love potion, so that if things aren't very good with King Mark, Isolde can take the love potion and fall in love with him and it'll be better. But if things really are bad, there's also a death potion in there. It's not clear whether you put that in for yourself or whether you got your mother to do it.
No, it's not clear.
So somehow there's a love potion and a death potion.
So the love potion...
No, she does say, Brangaena does say she's put in a death potion. She does say that
the mother
did give it to her.
Has provided
yes.
both.
Yes.
So
right.
basically,
good mother.
If I don't like the guy that much, I'll take the love potion. If
right.
that doesn't work and it gets really bad, I'll take the
death
exactly.
potion. Right? Life with a sorceress as a mother is just different.
Yeah.
Different.
So here we are on the ship. And at the beginning of the opera, after an overture, which is extraordinary, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, we hear a sailor singing and sort of making fun of Isolde, because all the mariners on the boat have had enough of her. She's not an easy traveler. And so Isolde hasn't endeared herself to anyone, and she says to her confidant and her maid, Brangaena, "Go get Tristan and tell him to come and talk to me." Tristan politely refuses. He says, "I've got to sail a ship. I've got to get her safely to King Mark." Finally, Isolde makes it impossible for him to refuse. So he comes. And she says, "You owe me this courtesy. We should drink a drink together." And she says to Brangaena, "Go get the death potion." So Isolde slugs it down, and then Tristan grabs it, and he does too.
He goes first.
That's right, he goes first.
Because he declares his honor before drinking it, knowing that he's about to be killed.
And then the end.
No.
Well, no. Because
that's only the first act.
Brangaena, the serving maid, has her own ideas. So instead of giving them the death potion, she gives them the love potion.
Ah.
Oh, it's such a good story.
And so then they fall madly in love with each other.
They do. Needless to say, this is inconvenient because she's about to be given to this powerful king, Tristan's uncle, whom he adores and whom he respects very much. But he's now in love with his bride.
And she with him. So then what happens?
Well there's an intermission and everybody goes out and drinks for half an hour.
You're right.
And drinks their love potions from the bar.
That's
the
right. Isolde can't wait to see Tristan. So she has a signal arranged outside of King Mark's castle. King Mark and his men go out on a hunt, and there's a big torch in front of the castle gate. And she's told Tristan, "When that torch goes out, you come, and I will be waiting for you." You want to pick up the thread?
Yeah, I'm not as good at summarizing as you, but I'll do my best. So she has Brangaena extinguish the torch, the fakkel, and Tristan arrives, and they have a very important philosophical love duet, which is also incredibly sensual, about the day and night, which is Schopenhauer, basically.
Right.
And unfortunately, the man who he considered his best friend and the man that Isolde trusted, Melot, has told the king about the situation.
Uh-oh.
So
he's betrayed Tristan.
Yes.
Right.
As they are about to consummate their relationship, maybe again, who knows? Or in one production, which I love, as they're about to take a suicide potion together. King Mark comes in.
I guess she didn't
and
throw it away.
Them.
Yeah, right. They still have that left over. They drank the love potion.
So he catches them. So that they are interrupted, and the tragedy begins, really, in the sense that King Mark, who is a very loving and wise man, has been betrayed by the person he trusted most in the world, Tristan.
Right.
And one of the guy that's betrayed Tristan, Melot, tries to protect King Mark, or protect his honor, and wounds Tristan mortally. End of Act Two.
So there's a whole other act.
There's a whole other act.
Yes.
Because once...
And this is opera, so we can give it all away.
Yes, I think so.
I'm guessing everyone dies.
How did you know that?
Surprise.
Just a really good guess.
No, actually, in this opera, they go to the Caribbean and everything is forgiven.
Exactly.
No, just
right,
kidding.
And they dance some salsa.
That's right.
No,
so what does happen is that Tristan goes to Brittany, and he is recovering with his dear friend Corvinal, and he's just hoping that before he dies, Isolde will come. But everything in Wagner is long, and he waits a long time.
As does the audience.
As does the audience, to see if this is going to happen.
Right.
And in the end, sure enough, it does happen. Not only does Isolde show up, but King Mark shows up again. And this time, he knows everything about the love potion.
Now, so he realizes it wasn't really anybody's fault.
Not only that, but he was prepared to forgive them and unite them and say it's all fine, but he's too late.
As is she.
As is she.
Ah, so Tristan dies.
He does.
With Isolde's entrance, of course.
Well, that's... Now, do love potions like that, do they wear off?
The last time I had... I can't remember.
That'd be interesting.
This one doesn't.
5 years later.
I haven't done that part of the character study. I guess I'm failing.
Well, actually, I read about this. There are several versions of the Tristan and Isolde story. And in some versions, the love potion wears off after 3 years.
Really?
Really. That I'm not making up. But in Wagner's mind, love is eternal. And this love potion never wears off.
And I must tell you that... In going into Tristan and Isolde productions, generally the first discussion that we have as a team is whether there's even a potion at all. Because many people, and myself included, would hold from what the music tells us that from the beginning, Tristan's in love with Isolde and Isolde's in love with Tristan. And that the love potion releases those inhibitions. Now, so some Tristans actually believe that he didn't like her at all beforehand. But from my perspective...
Well, I mean, there is the whole killing the fiancé angle.
You know, this was the Middle Ages. People killed each other for all kinds of seemingly commonplace reasons.
And Unlike now.
Unlike now.
You weren't watching the news last night, obviously.
And so if Tristan kills somebody as a matter of honor, that doesn't mean that he dislikes the woman that was going to marry him. He just had to do it.
Right. So you, Jean-Michel Charbonnet, we're talking to Joe Illick of the Santa Fe Concert Station and Jean-Michel Charbonnet, have played Isolde in all sorts of productions, predominantly mm-hmm. in Europe, I think.
Yes, always. I'm about to do it for the first time in the United States.
I know, in Dallas.
In Dallas, very close to Santa Fe.
You're doing four performances starting on the 16th of February and going through the 25th of February at the Dallas Opera. Ladies and gentlemen who might want to take a little Southwest flight, just a little couple hours east. But anyway, what is it like for you to interpret this role over and over the course of a career?
Well, it's a huge honor and a gift for me. This is my favorite opera. I have one other I would put right up there with it.
What's that?
Bluebeard's Castle of Bartok. I have many operas I adore, but this is my favorite.
Okay.
In part because I so adore the character of Isolde. She's an amazing woman on so many levels.
What do you like about her?
Well, I like that she's fiery and committed, and she's a princess. I kind of enjoy that aspect. The clothes. No. What I enjoy about playing her is that I have such a path, such an arc of character in the process of the opera. She begins angry, hurt, always powerful, always verbal. We won't say she ever shuts her mouth. And then she becomes almost a teenager in love in the process of the love potion and her co-joining with Tristan. So that is just so interesting to already be those two sides of the character. And the love is, I think, very sensual and sexual, but also deeply spiritual. So you see a person go through a real arc of a life. And, of course, at the end, she's also devastated.
How old is she supposed to be? It's not a Romeo and Juliet where she actually is 15 years old or something.
Again, that's a discussion that all directors want to have. Most directors that I've worked with are happy to put her in around 30. But you could play her as young as 17 or 18.
Yeah, and 30 in medieval years is like 45.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's just their way to not complicate how we look. Although I will say that in Wagner, most people aren't singing this role at 30 years old. This is a role that happens later in one's life because this is a dramatic soprano repertoire. Obviously, it takes a huge amount of stamina to sing for 5 hours and to sing a lot in 5 hours.
Just want to make sure everybody heard that. This opera is 5 hours long, basically sung by two people over a 100-piece orchestra the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's quite a feat.
And they never do it.
Which is probably also something I like about it, because I like challenges.
They never do it in Santa Fe because the sun goes down so late and you'd be there till 2 in the morning.
That, and I think that the orchestra's so huge. Santa Fe, the orchestra they use here is.
But it could be done in Santa Fe.
With a reduced orchestra?
Well.
And oxygen tanks.
I think that they've had orchestras just as big when they did Elektra, and it would be beloved by thousands of people. So
it would be fabulous to do.
Just saying.
It would be incredible to do in this setting.
It would, but, I mean, isn't the air here kind of thin?
No.
For singing that much?
Stop.
Really?
Yes,
no, that's
fun.
What I've heard. That's the people
singers,
say.
Definitely the altitude is something that one has to adjust to, and in the process of the summer, all the singers at Santa Fe Opera adjust. This kind of an opera, the same people that sing the Magic Flute are not going to sing Tristan. So you're going to have a different kind of singer that have a different kind of training, so the stamina is not the issue.
Do you remember?
I agree. And also, an opera that begins at 7 o'clock and ends at, you know, just a little after midnight, it would be okay to have the first act of Tristan in the light.
Yes, because Tristan is about light and dark, day and night.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Santa Fe Opera, if you are listening now.
Charles, please forgive us. We didn't discuss this beforehand.
So, do you remember the first time you sang?
Yes.
Isolde?
How could you not remember that?
I don't remember the first time I sang Isolde. Oh, well, yeah, that's right. I've
tomorrow.
Never sung Isolde.
Maybe you'll sing it tomorrow. The first time I sang it was in a production in Naples, Italy. That was quite... Luis Pascual was the director, Spanish director. And the conductor was Gary Bertini, who was a wonderful old Israeli director at the time. It was a conductor, sorry.
And what was it like for you to... I mean, this is a kind of lifetime achievement in a way to sing that role and then to go through your very first performance. I can't even imagine. Did you have stage fright?
Well, I've been singing for a long time, so I do have nerves, but I don't have stage fright. So I won't say that. I did have respect and awareness of the huge task I was undertaking, as well as awareness of its place in history. And what it means to be someone who gets to sing this kind of music. So there was the responsibility of being in that line. But yes, the whole experience is imprinted in my mind, but the thing that I can tell you is the Liebestod, the final aria that Isolde sings when she comes in over the body of Tristan and when she transfigures, really, when she sees him becoming alive and something more, and she joins him, is the experience of standing with that orchestra and singing that music is like nothing else in the world. It is otherworldly.
Now, you're going to be doing, the two of you, a program this weekend, and it's the Saturday.
Saturday at 4
o'clock. At 4 o'clock at the United Church of Santa Fe. So what will you be doing? You'll be both playing the piano, you'll be singing, Jean-Michel, talking about Wagner. Tell us about the program.
I would just like people who come to get a feeling for who Wagner was, how influential he was, how his music affected the whole development of Western music, and why he chose almost exclusively medieval stories, why he wrote all the words himself, what were the philosophical ideas that were important to him. And I think that people are naturally frightened off by operas that are so long, but there are so many things that you can find out about that give you something to hang on to, so that time really passes much more quickly than you think it's going to. Now, of course, we're going to be...
And it's an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So this will pass really quickly.
This will pass really quickly.
And I have to say, I'm just going to be singing two things, and I can't wait to
just
be charmed and educated and entertained by Joe, who's so brilliant, both at the piano and in his information sharing.
When I was 11, my mother and I went to the San Francisco Opera, and I went to my first opera. There were $3 student rush tickets, and we were in the back row of a 3,500-seat opera house. We didn't really know what we were seeing. We just thought it would be cool. And it was Tristan and Isolde with a woman named Birgit Nilsson, who was singing the lead
my goodness.
Role. And a tenor named Wolfgang Windgassen. And Wolfgang wasn't as powerful at that point in his career, I guess, as she was. But this was 1970. And my mother, by the end, was sleeping peacefully next to me. It was past midnight. And I was just sitting on the edge of my chair thinking, Birgit Nilsson is singing to only me.
That's amazing that you saw
that, Joe. At the age of 11.
It was incredible. So,
did that change your life? Did that set your career?
Yeah. It meant that we went to San Francisco Opera a lot, and I was in a boys' chorus, and our boys' chorus provided boys for all the operas that needed boys, like Faust and Otello and Carmen, and I got to sing in some of these. So it was wonderful. And yes, it really changed things for me. So I'm glad to be back with Tristan and Isolde.
And we're sharing it with lots of people.
Yeah.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
We're going to go out with some of the music from the Liebestod, and this is actually sung by you, Jean-Michel. So we're going to hear a little clip of that in a moment. But I want to ask you, I mean, you have here a combination of deep philosophical ideas on the part of Richard Wagner. You also have a major league womanizer who is creating his ideal love. How do those things work together?
I think they work together perfectly. Wagner fell in love with ideas just as passionately as he fell in love with women. And it seems sensible that he would create the union of the two, but had to go to art to do it, because the kinds of things that he imagined didn't exist in real life. The operas that he imagined didn't exist. Wagner not only created a whole new kind of opera, he had to create a new kind of opera house, invent instruments. I mean, he he wasn't content with anything as it existed. He had an incredibly creative mind and had the will and the manipulative abilities to get people to help him create everything that he wanted to bring into existence.
The event is this Saturday at 4 o'clock. It's the Santa Fe Concert Association, whom you can find on the web at santafeconcerts.org. Joe Illick is the artistic director. Jean-Michel Charbonnet is a world-renowned soprano whom we have the great privilege of hearing, because usually she is singing in Europe, although, as we said before, you'll be singing in Dallas in February at the Dallas Opera. And this event is co-presented with the Wagner Society of Santa Fe. And if you want to hear more about what they are up to, you can simply write to Wagner Society of Santa Fe at gmail.com. Joe Illick and Jean-Michel Charbonnet, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It was absolutely an adorable conversation. Thanks.
And now let's hear some of the Liebestod. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.